our special Wednesday morning feature. Every Wednesday after the 11 o'clock news, we are joined by two guests in the studio, usually Bob Metz and Jeff Schlemmer, and that is the case today. Welcome to both of you.
Morning, Jim.
Occasionally we've had folks fill in when the guys can't make it for one reason or another, and that's fine, but we always like to have our two heavy hitters with us. This program, this next part of the program, indeed, is about, well, it's about a whole lot of things. It's about political philosophy. It's about attitudes towards life. It's about a whole lot of things. And our two guests today tend to view the world, I think, from slightly different perspectives. And some people would say from radically different perspectives. That's what drives this portion of the program. We do talk about issues that are out there, things that are important to the community, to the world at large, and sometimes just individual issues. And we try to take a look at them from the perspective of someone who, as I've said many times, is generally to the right of center, someone who's generally to the left of center, and someone who's sort of in the center. That would be me, recognizing that those boundaries are artificial at best, and sometimes we all will move around within that continuum. The question I have this morning for you guys is this. There's a story in the paper, and it's not a new story, about the Western faculty voting as to whether they're going to unionize their faculty or not. Now, the context of this, folks, is that some people, some of the activists, the union activists, believe that they are being, abused by the administration, and they're being shut out of the process. The phrase that factory was used, they're turning it into a factory. And the union people claim that their wish is to restore a professional environment. People on the other side say that's nonsense, that there's more consultation with the faculty and so on, and more faculty participation in decision-making than at most other institutions of higher learning in Canada, and that this is kind of a red herring, that there are other issues at work here in terms of getting the union in, and whatever that may mean. Jeff Schlemmer, of course, does some work at Western, teach up there at Western, and I'm going to start with you, Jeffrey. First, I'm assuming that you're in support of this drive to unionize.
Well, I've got my union card out right here. I have to tell you that I was until Bill 7 went through, a member of the Brewery General and Professional Workers Union, and we became the first lawyers to unionize in 1994 when Bill 40 went through, which made it legal for lawyers to be unionized in the first place. And I guess from my perspective, yes, I would support it if people want it, that these are things that are voted on, but that the faculty at Western are smart people who can figure out for themselves whether there's an advantage to having a union or not, that they would be paying dues, obviously, so they're going to have to get something in return for that. I would trust them to figure out whether it is advantageous. I recall back in the 70s when I was at Western taking a course in industrial relations, and at that time the thesis was that good management doesn't get unions. You know, that unions arise as a result of problems with management. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Western was sort of proud of the fact that nobody was unionized at Western. And then several years after that, the support staff unionized. And so I guess this may be the next logical step. And I would wonder sort of what's going on. Now, what I suspect is going on is that there have been substantial cuts at universities. There's under a lot of financial pressure. It's tight times there, and that when times get tight, people start looking for ways of protecting their jobs and things like that. But generally, unions, from my perspective, obviously I like my union. My union's been very good to me, and solved a situation with my employer. And I think that people who are not familiar with sort of the inside workings of unions are often see them as being much more... They demonize them, and the experience I've had with unions in town, particularly the CAW union, has been terrific. They've done wonderful work around social issues and things. But I recognize that their unions have had problems, if you want to look at the Teamsters and some of their history in the past and so on. But generally, unions, from my perspective, are an organization that comes in to redress a power imbalance if there's some problem. And again, if there's a problem, you have to ask, well, what's management doing about it?
Robert?
I'm listening to Jeff, and I think there's two sides to the whole union picture. I think the side that the public sees isn't the one that you just talked about, where you can take a personal issue to your union rep and have it dealt with, which I'm not quite sure why you would think a union would be better than a voluntary employee organization or association, but maybe you can get back into that later. Yeah. But I think the public generally sees unions... Like myself, and a lot of people I know, you see unions as lobby groups. You're adding more politicization of the campus environment rather than trying to fight against it. But ironically, I think the in part, the teachers are saying, or the professors are saying, that that's what they want to fight. So, you know, if, as you say, Jim, they feel abused by the administration and that they're being put into this factory situation, I would say that's in large part due to the way that the campus is being funded and the government cutbacks and that whole relationship that really shouldn't be there.
So is this move to unionization, is it an attempt to deny reality? The reality is that we do have budget cuts, we don't have the money we had, we are going to have to restructure, but the union, in this case, it seems that the union's position would be, although it's not extant yet, but the union's position obviously would be, no, we're going to oppose all this, we're going to oppose these changes. Is this King Canute trying to hold the stop the waves from crashing on the shore?
This is what worries me, is when it gets politicized to the point where the union start having an almost equal say in the running of the institution, when really that is the administrator's responsibility, and they're the ones who get the flack for it or the praise for it, depending on how well things go. You say, unions are trying to, are they trying to protect people from reality? Yeah, to some degree. I mean, unions have traditionally been against having competitive labor, allowing people to compete for wages and things like that. But that's a given with the union, I think. In terms of the specific problems that they have on campus, I really don't know of anything specifically. Are there any mentioned in that article today that
Well, just the idea that it's being turned into an education factory, there are cutbacks, and not just this article, but the background in it, too. And Jeff, perhaps you maybe can have more insight into it than I do, but the sense is that there have been a lot of changes, that there are a lot of pressures on faculty. There have been downsizing, not only of faculty, but of non-faculty staff that some people feel is impacting negatively on education.
Now, one thing that occurs to me that's sort of interesting as I think through it, and that is that with university faculty, they've already got one of the things that most people look to from a union, and that is tenure within the university system. As you know, right now, that if you're there a certain number of years and you're promoted to a full professorship, then you have tenure, which basically means you can't be fired for all practical purposes. And often for people who unionize, that's one of the main reasons you do it, and that is, under the law, if you're not in a union, you can be fired any time. The only remedy you have in law is damages. That is, you can get paid a certain amount of time until you find a new job. Whereas if you're in a union, you actually cannot be fired. You have a right to keep your job sort of on good behavior, and provided that the company isn't laying off, you can't be fired at will, basically.
We should make that point, too, which has been made on this program and also on our Ask the Experts program with the Mikes, Izanga, and Peerless, the lawyers who join us once a month, that in our society today, a lot of people don't realize this, you can be fired for no reason at all.
Yep.
If you're not a member of a union or a protective organization.
Right.
And that's well within the employer's rights, and the idea is that if the employer no longer has a use for your services, there's no reason why he should be compelled to keep you. A lot of people don't understand that.
If he doesn't like the color of your eyes, he can fire you.
Not legally, but practically,
you'll have to pay damages. Yeah. But you won't get your job back.
It also depends if there's a written contract in place that you can have recourse to.
Exactly.
But in the absence of that, that's true.
In the absence of that, we are at the mercy of our employers, the same as they are at our mercy, because we also can leave it at any time for any reason.
Now, one thing that's particularly interesting about Western, and one of the questions you had posed was about the automatic dues checkoff, and whether you should have to pay dues if you choose not to be a member of the union. Well, of course, you know where that started. It's called the Rand formula.
Mm-hmm.
It's named after Dean Ivan Rand, who was a justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, who also was the first dean of law at the University of Western Ontario. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of an interesting little tie in there that he's the guy who figured out this compromise as a way of making labor things work back in the 50s.
It's not a compromise. It's a complete capitulation of one side to the other.
Yes, before I was born, I don't know what it was about, but I suspect that both parties, you know, were at loggerheads and that he worked this thing out. But anyway, it'll be interesting to see what the
I want to talk about that, because that's one of the sticking points of this whole business. And I have told this story before about my father, who worked in an industry here in the city, and particularly in his later years, and was compelled to join a union. And the union had really nothing to do with his particular job within the company. They did negotiate some very minor salary increases for him, but they also took the company out on strike four times during the 12 years that he worked there. And he figured out that they'd actually cost him thousands of dollars of money that he never recovered from losing during that period of time.
I had the same experience.
And his beef was that not only did they compel him to not to work, which he, I guess to a point, was prepared to live with. He recognized the realities and some of the beefs that some of the other people had in the corporation. But he never could figure out, let me rephrase that, he figured it out, but he never approved of the idea that he had to pay dues nonetheless. Even though patently and observably and provably this union was working to his personal detriment, he still had to pay the dues.
Yeah, when, and of course the rationale for that, as I understand it, is that if the union is there theoretically trying to advance your interests, that you should participate in funding the union, that the concern, I guess, from the standpoint of the unions was that people will take advantage of wage increases that are negotiated by the unions and yet not contribute anything to the legal costs.
But what
and
if you don't
stuff.
Get them?
Well, and that's another thing.
And what would be wrong with opting out? What would be wrong with saying, I do not choose to join the union in this plant, and I will negotiate my salary, I will negotiate my wage with my employer directly. I don't want your protection, union, thank you very much. If the unionized guys get more money than I do, then God bless you, go to it. But I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm not up on the rationale for that. I know that Dean Rand was considered to be a smart guy, and that he probably had a good reason for doing what he did.
My dad didn't think he was very smart.
I'm just he's supposed to be a smart judge anyway.
Didn't benefit. Well, yeah.
No, he didn't help him. No, that's fine. I understand that. And I understand that it's offensive to be required to belong to any organization you don't feel like belonging to, and then to contribute
to one. So you agree that it's offensive. So obviously you don't support it then.
Well, the first thing is you don't have to belong to it. You have to pay for it.
Well,
that's different.
What's the difference?
Well, and this raises, like, for instance, this came up at Fanshawe College a few years ago, where there's a question about people who are on the faculty association having to pay union dues to whichever union it was, which then paid money to the NDP,
yes,
to support the NDP.
Yeah.
And the question was, should the staff members who don't like the NDP have to be funding their campaigns?
Mm-hmm.
And I can
or
see
even
that.
The ones who do like the NDP, should somebody be forcing them to fund the NDP? That's an entirely inappropriate use of union money, and that's why people regard unions as a lobby group. To me,
again,
the whole issue of unions is voluntarism versus force. Are you allowed to join a union voluntarily? Like, in my mind here, I'm thinking about this union on campus as being voluntary, and I'm going, oh my goodness, what am I thinking? No, that's not the way it is. Everybody's going to be forced to join it, including the ones that don't want to.
If a majority vote for it.
Why does the majority have power over minority? Like, you know, can't I belong to the clubs I want to, but because five people want to belong to Club X, I got to be forced to be in that club?
Well, and when you talk about the idea of having voluntary opting out and saying I'll negotiate my own pay and negotiate my own discipline and all that stuff, I think that would be an interesting idea, because I happen to think in the negotiations that I've done in my life that unless you have some base of power, you're not going to get very far. And if an individual tries to negotiate with GM and GM doesn't happy with them, they'll be gone.
Your power should be your skills and what you have to offer in trade in exchange for what your employer wants. That's your power.
But
if you don't have the skills he wants, you've got no power. You can have all the unions in the world. They're not going to get you a job.
And I think we are seeing more of that, in the sense that we're seeing far more contracting out. We're seeing far more subcontracting of work. We're seeing far more people working on contracts who are their own, you know, their own bargaining agent, if you like. I think that is a trend. However, from my standpoint, if I was bargaining for anything, whether it's wages or whatever, I think that I'll be much more effective if there's a bunch of me in it together.
Okay, guys, we're going to pause for just a moment. The lines are open, 643-1290, star 1290 on the Cantel. It's left, right, and center on 1290 CJBK. It's left, right, and center with Jeff Schlemmer and Bob Metz. We're talking this morning about the unionization of the University of Western Ontario. UWO faculty is going to vote on that, and my question to the guys was, is this appropriate? Is this the kind of working group that should be unionizing? Is the proper atmosphere for an institution of higher learning to be politicized like this? And what about this issue of paying dues, too? I mean, if you don't want to join, should you be forced to, and should you have to pay dues? We've got Bill, who's been waiting. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how you doing, Jim?
Fine, thank you.
I don't see anything wrong with them being unionized, because, like, the doctors, they have an association, which is like a union.
Yeah.
And if, you know, if it's a Democratic vote and 51% decide to have them, then they should have them.
Should the other 49% be forced to join?
Oh, I think they should, because what Justice Rand proposed when he put through that legal stuff. And another thing, it's like a government, you know, if I don't vote for a government, I still have to abide by what the majority wants.
Do you think that's right, Bill?
Democratic.
So if democratically the majority decided to do something that you regarded as immoral, would you go along with it?
I wouldn't want to, but you might have to. But I don't consider unions immoral.
I think forcing someone to do something against their will is immoral. That's the basic premise of immorality, isn't it?
Well, using you could force say that about
to get what you want.
Say,
yes, you can.
Well, I want to go through a red light, but they're forcing me to stop.
Oh no, that's a different issue. Why would you compare the two things?
How is it
different, you're just
Bob?
Saying immoral, so I don't know what your definition of immoral is.
Let's find out, Bob. How is that different?
Well, it's interesting that people generally, whenever you want to say that you have the right to make your choices, you know, that they refer to some traffic situation.
Well,
you can't
I'm not
through
a lawyer.
A stop
I don't
sign
know
or
the
a red
illegal.
Bill, let Bob answer, if you would.
Yeah.
The difference in a traffic situation is that everyone's being treated equally. Everyone is abiding by a law. No one's forced to make... To be told where they can go in traffic. That's the mechanism is there so that you can have the choices. If you were allowed to go through a red light, you wouldn't have any choice of where to go. That would be deadly to you. I mean, the reasons are obvious. This is not the case in economics. People generally take the physical or political and start applying it to economics.
It's not all about economics, though. It's about working conditions, too, which would affect all the workers that were in the bargaining unit.
Well, don't you think the people who don't want to be in a union have reasons not to want to be in a union, and shouldn't they have the same choice that the people who want to be in the union?
But you understand what Justice Rand proposed, that they're going to get the same benefits whether they're paying or not, so eventually the union's going to go under because people are going to say, well, he's getting the same and he's not paying.
Well,
so it'd be a union-killing thing.
Well, then you wouldn't have to give the same benefits. I'm not arguing for that.
No, you know the employer would, because when a plant tries to unionize, the employers usually try to stop the union from going through.
So, Bill,
look at the Michelin plant in Nova Scotia.
Bill, it's Jim here. I just want to ask you a philosophical question here then.
Okay.
Is it okay then to compel you to do something you don't want to do for the good of the rest of society? Is that okay?
I guess so.
Okay, no, that's fair enough. I just want to make everybody understand that that's what you believe. So if the government came along tomorrow and said to you, Bill, you've got to put your kids in daycare because we think it's best for the society, and a majority of people support it. How would you feel about that?
Well, one thing you're talking about economics.
Don't duck the question. Come on, Bill, it's a fair question.
Well, I would say I wouldn't mind putting my kids in for a few days, but I don't know if I'd want them in there all the time because I'd like to teach them too.
Bill, what if the government said to you, Bill, here's the deal. Majority of people believe that all kids should be in full-time daycare, and your kids are going in daycare whether you like it or not.
Well, I wouldn't like that.
But would you do it?
Oh, I don't know. If they threatened to throw me in jail, maybe. I can't really say. Probably not.
Well, why wouldn't you do that? Why would you think it's okay for Justice Rand to compel you to join the union if you didn't want to, but it's not okay for Justice whoever in enforcing the law to say, Bill, your kids are going in daycare? I don't understand where you see there's a difference there. I'm not saying you shouldn't believe what you believe. I'm just asking why you see there's a difference. What's the difference?
Well, I guess the difference to me is that I believe in unions and that they...
Well, that's no answer. That's not an answer, though. With all due respect, that's not an answer. It's the same argument, and I'm asking you the question, why do you believe in one but not in the other? Is it just because one's more convenient than the other? Or is it something? And I really want to know. I'm not trying to abuse you at all.
I
want to know.
I understand. I just believe in the union movement. I don't know how to describe. I believe in that it helps the workers out, you know, that they believe they should have a share in the profit.
Sure. Okay, that's all fine. But what about, again, if the majority of Canadians believed that it helps?
I guess if you're going to ask me, I don't agree with everything. If the majority agrees with something that I'm totally against, then I guess I can see your point.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that I'm pro-union.
Well,
that's all.
Fine. But you understand why some people would think that the Rand formula is not a good thing. You understand that?
Yeah, I can see that. Okay. But, I mean, that would be their belief system, right?
Yep.
You see, but I think what the difference is between you and me, Bill, is that I would take your belief in unions and say, yes, you're entitled to it. You have a freedom of belief and that you can practice what you believe.
You understand,
but you're telling me that because I don't believe in unions and I'm in a situation where a union's going to be forced on me, I cannot have that same freedom.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but all I'm saying, though, is that if you got the same benefits as me, which you know that if you're logical, you would probably believe that the employer would give it to you because they don't want a union in there in the first place. So then all these guys see you not paying, so then they opt out of the union, so eventually your union goes under, and that was the reason why Justice Rand put that in.
Well, so what you're saying is the only clout a union has is force, and that the only thing a union has to even justify itself is this use of force. And
well, that's what management has. And this
management
is
has
force
that
trying
too,
to
not have force.
Oh, I think that the person who signs your paycheck every week has a lot of force.
He can't force you to work for him. He can't force you to
you say
do
management
that,
does not have force, so how do they decide what you get paid then?
That's a negotiation you have.
Yeah, it's but like circumstances can force you to work for
them. Don't run the organization. They just want to say in it, eh?
Yeah. Bill, appreciate
like a little bit of say with working conditions and wages, like with if there's profits being made and such, you know.
Okay, appreciate the call, Bill.
Want a voice in the wilderness.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Okay.
But, Bob, I mean, seriously.
Circumstances are not forced, Jim. Circumstances are circumstances. Mother Nature does not coerce. Coercion is a human-to-human factor. When we talk about using force in society, we're talking about Mr. A forcing Mr. B, not the weather forcing you, not the conditions of nature.
What about your own desires forcing you? What about your desire to provide for a family in a stable situation? Don't you think that's force applied upon yourself?
It's a responsibility, and it's a social force or a moral force that impels you to act.
But it's force.
No, it's not force.
Negotiations are all about force. You know, when management says this is what you're going to get paid, whether you like it or not, that's force.
You're out of context. First of all, there's two different issues. You're dealing with the political one. Jim's dealing with nature and Mother Nature. I could say that there are tremendous forces on the surface of the sun, but we're not talking about that kind of thing.
No, you're ducking the question. Like, Bill, no, but the point I was trying to get at here was the idea for you to say that management has no force in the situation, has no power in the situation.
Oh, it indeed does. It's the employer.
But the individual may find him or herself a victim of internally generated force. They may have to have that job. It's fine for you to say you don't have to take the job. Well, you may have to take the job. You may not have an option. There may not be another job around that you can do. You may have a mortgage payment and a car payment and dental payments for the kids.
So then you choose to take that job instead of not taking the job. You still have the choice of not taking the job, but then the mortgage and all those other things you just talked about are going to catch up on you.
So you don't think there's any force being applied, or there's any pressure on that individual?
That's not my definition of force. Force, again, is physical force. It comes down to the physical. And if you're taking my money out of my pocket, or you're threatening me with jail, if you can't get the money out of my pocket, you're planning to rule my life for me and make my decisions for me, mm-hmm. my options in life, that's where force comes
in. Well, that's what management does.
But what about if I'm going to take your house away, and I'm going to take your car away, and I'm going to take your kids away because you can't support them? If you don't take the job.
Well, then I'll have the house, kids, and everything else taken away if I don't do that. That's right.
And you don't see that as being but kind of a complicating factor when we talk
absolutely,
about
absolutely, but
free
I don't call
for
it force. I don't call it force.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones with caller Larry. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Jim, Bob, and Jeff.
Hi.
Yes. I don't think a person should be forced to pay union dues, and the reason being, I was with the federal government for 21 years, from 1975 to 1996 at Wolsey Barracks in London. Here.
Yeah.
We paid union dues from day one, and we were told if you don't pay union dues, you got no job protection.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
This is when the Maroney government was in power. Well, I actually started when Trudeau was in power, then I worked for the Maroney years, and then John Cretton comes into power.
Mm-hmm.
When then rumor became reality, we started losing our jobs because the federal government cutbacks.
Yeah.
Darryl Bean, I don't know if I should mention his name or not, was a national president with the department, with the PSAC.
Yeah.
And we just lost our jobs through federal cutbacks, and they went to contract cleaners.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I paid union dues without complaint from my first paycheck to the last paycheck.
Yeah.
So I feel that a person should not be forced to pay union dues, and that was a case in point that they did not put a blanket over me at all.
They didn't deliver
for
you.
And the other workers either.
They didn't deliver what they promised, did
they? No, they did not. They told you, if you paid union dues, you got job protection.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot lay you off. They cannot, you know, the whole nine yards. But, well, they just literally stab us in the back. Sure, yeah. Give us a buyout, but that's not the point. I'd rather have my job than the buyout.
There you go.
Larry, I got a job now. I'm literally just existing now.
Yeah. Larry, thanks for the call today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. And Bruce joins us. Hi, Bruce.
Morning, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
It's my understanding, I don't know if this is right, I'm sure maybe somebody there knows better than me, that if the place I'm working at is then organized by a union, not already unionized when I get my job there, if for whatever personal reasons I just decide that I don't want any part of it, that yes, I may have to sign a union card and, you know, become a quote-unquote a member, but it is my option not to support them financially. I still have to pay the same amount of money as everybody else who, in union dues, but it is my option to have it redirected to a charity. Is that not true?
Well, first of all, you can't be required to sign a union card, okay, so you don't have to belong to a union. But my understanding of the RAND formula is that you can be required to participate in paying union dues. I haven't heard of being able to redirect the money elsewhere.
I haven't heard of that either, but maybe one of our, I know we have a number of union listeners, maybe they could phone and tell us. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I remember there was discussion about it, but I don't recall it ever becoming a fact.
Yeah, I don't think it was.
Okay, because that was just my understanding that, yeah, you couldn't force me to, well, I guess as you just said, you can't force me to join the union, and if I don't want any part of it, I have the ability to say I don't want to be a member of the union, and nor do I want to support it financially.
Well, I think we're three of us are agreed. As far as we know, that's not the case. You will be forced to support it financially.
Oh. Although I'm thinking about it. It seems to me that there was discussion about that around the Fanshawe issue, and I don't know how it came out or what it was about, whether it was a proposal or whether.
But wasn't that, I'm a little fuzzy on it too. But wasn't that specifically about the amount of money that might be donated to the political party?
Yes.
Rather than all of the dues, per
right.
se.
That's right. But they were saying that if you don't support the NDP, there was some discussion of, well, okay, that part of money can go to someplace else, a charity or something.
Bruce, we're going to have to ask our listeners if one of them perhaps has a little more up-to-date knowledge on this than
okay.
we do. Yeah, thanks for the
thanks.
Call today. Take
bye-bye.
Care. Bye-bye. 643-1290. Andrew's with us. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Jim.
Yes, sir.
I was just wondering, talking about unions and stuff, I was just wondering if your guests there had any experience with, instead of going with a union, if the workers got together and just hired a lawyer and just paid them monthly in case there's any problems in the future and stuff like that.
That's a great
idea. Like a labor lawyer.
Well, you can do that. And, of course, you can also have an association, an employee association, where you are not formally recognized as a union by the government, but that you work together.
The problem with a lawyer, what's a lawyer going to do for you?
Well, just, you know, in case there's any problems with the plant, like,
well,
say, working conditions or something.
Yeah, that's no problem. But if what you want is a lawyer who would protect your job, it can't happen. Because the employer, without in the absence of a union or collective bargaining agreement, the employer can fire you tomorrow for no reason, and there's nothing the lawyer can do about it.
Yeah, I have no problems with that. If you're like unskilled, I don't say that's the one thing I have a problem with with unions is like mm-hmm. you got an unskilled guy there and a guy that's really skilled now. They're making the same wage, you know. That's I think we should follow the law more, like the labor laws instead of the unions.
Alrighty, thanks for the call today.
Right,
take care.
One point that it raises for me, though, is that, of course, some of the unions, particularly the Canadian Auto Workers, have sort of the opposite, which is as a member of the union, you can participate in their legal services, which mm-hmm. is a legal program, almost like OHIP, if you like, but for legal services where you get your...
And a great idea. I think that's one of the, to my mind, that's one of the outstanding pluses of unions, are those kinds of programs where...
Yeah.
Where again you use purchasing power, if you will, or buying in bulk.
Bulk buying
to you know, I think in that sense, I think there's a very positive role for unions to be played in. And when I hear stories like that program, and like one of our callers talked about CAW being, or you talked about CAW being very involved in a lot of social issues and things, and I think that's, you know, personally, I think that's great. And I applaud them for doing that. I have a little trouble more on the political side of it, but certainly in my mind, and having read a lot about it, and I just read a book about the big strike in Windsor right after the war there, the Ford strike in Windsor, which was a horrible, horrible story. But again, you know, you see why people were pushed. You see why they went that far.
Yeah, the other thing that occurs to me, you know, when you talk about the unions donating to the NDP, that you've got, when you look at the donations by large corporations to the Liberals and the Tories and the Reform Party, and to me, it's just the same kind of thing, that the NDP are avowedly a pro-union party, and they say they'll support union legislation and support unions. It sort of makes sense that they would, you know, try and get that government elected.
But let me ask Bob about that, too, because it seems to me that the counter-argument would be that that no one is forced to own stock in those corporations who contribute to those parties. Is that the counter-argument?
I'm not sure if that's the exact sequitur to what Jeff just said. What was your, say that point again, Jeff?
Well, just that I know the Bank of Montreal, for instance, gives $1 million each year to the Liberals and to the Tories. I know that Eaton's gives a big chunk of money to the Reform Party, for instance, because they feel that those parties will support their organizations.
Yeah, they do that out of their profits, though.
Yeah, no, I know.
Which is a separate thing, and that's technically their money. You know, getting back
to... Isn't it the shareholders' money? They didn't ask the shareholders whether they wanted to contribute to a political party.
I think that they do, in a way, because if the shareholders disagreed strongly enough, I think you'd see those contributions stop.
But couldn't you say the same thing? Because I know you're opposed to the union contributing, are you not, to the NDP?
Oh, absolutely.
Well,
I'm not opposed to the union contributing to the NDP. I'm opposed to the union forcing dues from its members,
mm-hmm.
and even from its so-called non-members.
Yeah, but you said earlier that you also thought it was inappropriate to use that money to support a particular party.
Yes, because the money was coerced from the members. It wasn't voluntarily given.
Well,
profits earned are exchanged on a free market. You know, it gets back to this force issue.
No, it doesn't. No, wait. Before you get back to, no, it doesn't. Before you get there, before you go that far, back up a minute. Well, because I want to make sure I understand this. You're saying that the union, which takes money without asking, let's say that, it takes money without asking from its members. You have to give the money.
Right.
We don't ask your permission.
Like
you give us the dough. It's just like a tax. So you give us the dough, we're going to spend it on the NDP, whether you like it or not.
Right.
Now, the corporation, same situation. We're going to spend that money whether you like it or not.
What same situation?
Well,
whose money are they taking?
Okay, they are taking the money of their members, the people who own that corporation. All of those profits belong to the shareholders. Now, the management says, well, we're not going to give you all of the profits. Some of the profits we're going to give to the federal Liberals. Now, your point that you made a moment ago was, shareholders, if they don't like that, they can undertake to do whatever they have to do and change the management.
Right.
Well, I would suggest...
Technically, they're the owner.
And I would suggest to you that the same thing in the union. If the union members don't like it, they can undertake to change their elected representatives and stop doing it. I don't see the difference.
And in fact, that is a big controversy.
Yeah,
well, I don't see the difference.
Members in a union can elect their representatives, but they can't. The difference is the money from the members in the union is being coerced from them.
The money's being coerced from the stockholders.
If I'm a stockholder
and they give money to the Liberals instead of giving it to me, they haven't asked my position. They asked my permission. They've taken that money without my leave.
I think you're looking at a separate issue. The issue you're dealing with in a large corporation with huge stockholders is an issue of fundamentally what I would call democracy and the flaws in any system that works on a majority rule system. But I look at the shareholders as say they're a single owner, just a single mm-hmm. owner, okay? And that if the bank does something that owner disapproves of, or the administration does something that the owner disapproves of, they have the recourse to change that.
And so do the union members.
Not to change the profit situation. They have the recourse to change their representatives.
If the issue came up and if enough members of that union said, I don't want to give my money to the NDP.
Which the CAW said in the last provincial election, by the way.
And people can run within that union on that platform. Elect me and we'll stop giving money to the NDP. So
the thing is, because a union member is a coerced member, a shareholder is a person who bought shares voluntarily. Nobody had a gun to his head to say, go out and buy these shares.
But they bought the shares with the expectation that they would get the dividends. It's the point I'm trying to make, and they're not asked what's going
to
happen with those dividends.
To me, if a large company is giving money to a political party, there may be a dividend in that we're not discussing right now, and that the shareholders recognize.
Do you think it's an appropriate dividend?
Appropriate in what sense? It's certainly, I don't see anything inappropriate to spend your own money that you earned and that you have the authority to spend that has been given to you.
My point, it's not your money, it's your shareholders' money. Anyway, we got to get back to the phones here. We got Frank waiting. Hi, Frank.
How are you, Jim?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I just joined the program not long ago. I heard the words union force and things like that.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of interesting, over the last 2 years, the union that I belong to and some of the other members, we've tried to remove ourselves from the union. And there's interesting reasons why. Basically, it's because, first of all, I work for a company, a sub-trade of a construction company. And we belong to a local, and there's only one other company in London of all the other sub-trades of the same trade. There's only two of us that are signatory to any union agreement.
Yeah.
And what that poses as a problem is that we have to compete with lower labor costs, of course. Basically, Jim, unions make too much money, especially in the construction industry. I don't know about other sectors, but in the construction industry, unions really, they're pretty outdated. maybe if it was the 70s, I could see maybe how they were beneficial. But
so what's the solution? Because you know at the beginning of the unions in the construction industry, at least one element of it, not the only element, but one element was that guys are being hired on a day-by-day basis, had no security, no sense that if I do a good job today, I'll have a job tomorrow, because it wasn't you know that's where it came from.
Right.
Now, I agree with you that it in some industries, and construction is one of them, it maybe has become distorted, but do you want to do away with it altogether? Or?
Absolutely, Jim.
You want to go back to the way it was?
There's no benefit to us from being in our union.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely none at all, Jim. I just received my receipt from my the union dues that I paid,
yep.
And it's over $900 for mm-hmm. the last year.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's about $23 a month. Plus
did you work all year?
An hour.
Did you work all year?
No. Oh, we okay. haven't worked all year, okay. probably since 1989, Jim.
Okay.
And the number one reason is because of the labor cost. We can go down the road and work for the other guy, make less money, perhaps work more.
Mm-hmm. Shouldn't you do that then?
No, well, interestingly enough, that's what everybody says. Well, why don't you go work for him then? Well, it's the sort of company where we are now that we want to stay working for. It's a very reputable company.
But that's
They've
your
been
choice,
around
then.
For a long, long time. The management is the best to work for. We feel very secure there without having anything tied to the union.
You can also decertify if you get organized.
No, we cannot.
Anybody can decertify.
No, you can't.
As a matter of fact, sir, I've tried to do that myself along with a couple of other fellows over the last few years, and I've been in touch with my MP, who didn't really want to help too much because they were unionized as well. We've really tried to, and what it takes is for the whole province of our local, the whole province, and that's consisting of, I don't know how many members, it's got to be up near 2,000 to 3,000 members. They would all have to vote.
Well, you're saying it's hard, but that's not
no,
to say
no,
you can't
they would
do
all
it.
Have
come
to
on,
vote.
Jeff. It's like
I don't understand that.
It's like saying, you know, you could jump from Europe to North America.
It's not
if
easy
you really
to get unions
wanted.
In. It's not easy to get unions out. It's hard to do change.
But listen, why would they want to
it's
let
not
us.
Hard. It's impossible.
No,
they
it's
won't
not.
Want to let us remove ourselves from the union because they're de-strengthening their numbers.
Yeah, exactly. Frank, yeah. I got to leave it there, but I appreciate your call and your thoughts today.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. Jeff, I got to follow up on that, because that's ridiculous.
Oh.
You can't, and there's a couple of instances, a guy named Randall Klein who's been fighting a battle of the people at his factory.
Oh, I've heard about Randall Klein.
For a number of years.
Yeah, I know about that.
Well, you know, yeah. The people who work for him. Okay. In any case, it is not, in a practical sense, it is what they're talking about. It is extremely difficult to decertify a union because you cannot do it with just the people in the local who want to do it. So, well, so for all practical purposes, it's impossible.
I guess it may be where I come from. I'm used to dealing with issues that are hard to get anywhere on. I'm used to trying to do social issues where it's extremely hard to get change. So for my end of it, it's like, well, that's what we do. We plug away at it to try and get change. Right now, these guys have got the most sympathetic government they're ever going to have provincially. Mm-hmm. If they can't talk those guys into making changes that are sympathetic to them, then there's something wrong. Like, this government does not support unions. If these guys get organized politically, they should be able to get the changes they want. And they already have. There have been substantial changes mm-hmm. to labor law already. Bill 7 was a huge change, brought back the right to bring in replacement workers, for instance, during strikes. So I say to him, you know, nothing in life is easy, but if this is an important issue, you'll never have a better time than now to accomplish that change.
We have to pause for a moment. We'll be back with more on Talk of the Town's Left, Right, and Center. And our next caller is Terry. You've got some information about forwarding your dues to charity. Is that right?
You're talking to Terry?
Yes.
Yes. Under our article, the Public Service Alliance of Canada, the Master Agreement,
mm-hmm.
Where they are, you know, the employer's taking dues out of your pay.
Right.
There's a clause that says an employee who satisfies the employer to the extent that he or she declares in an affidavit that she's a member of a religious organization that's registered under the Income Tax Act.
Yes.
And whose doctrine prevents them from a matter of conscience making a financial contribution to an employee organization can make a contribution to a charitable organization equal to the dues.
But you couldn't do it if it was just your personally held belief.
No, it sounds like it has to be under because of a religious belief.
Okay. What religion that would be.
I do too. Sounds to me like another one of those RAND deals that doesn't sound funny.
Is that just the agreement that you have there, Terry? Or
yeah,
it's
under our master agreement.
Okay, that's just a separate agreement.
Master agreement.
Yeah, it's under for the Public Service Alliance of Canada.
Great. Thanks for calling, Terry. I really appreciate you doing
that.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
A lot. And John joins us next. Hi, John.
Good morning, Jim.
Yes, sir.
Hats off to you, friend. Your right-wing supremacist lost his argument with you. And the argument I'm talking about in particular was rather a bizarre thing to say, that he's of the opinion that the majority have not the right to impose their will on the minority.
Well, they don't in an absolute sense, John.
Well, morally, but his argument
I'm speaking
was,
morally, John. I know legally they can do anything they want.
No, no. Well, okay then, morally. Now, let's put it this way. Would this apply to the criminal who has a criminal intent? Wait a minute, let me finish. The argument is this. You're suggesting minority and moral values. The criminal has no moral values. Are you suggesting that we don't have the right to impose a moral value on him?
No, you have the state has the right to protect individual rights, and if because a person has bad moral values, he's violating other people's rights, then the state has a right to intervene. But a person who has bad morals and isn't bothering anybody, we can't bother him either.
They argue that you can't legislate morality, and yet most of our legislation
comes down from a moral
viewpoint. But anyways, with regards to the RAND formula, which I'm well versed of, I took it a point to immerse myself in it some 30 years ago. The RAND formula basically ended up by, how shall we say, appeasing all and pleasing no one.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that was that there was, how shall we say, friction going on with regards to the union. So what Mr. Rand did basically was gave the union a little bit and gave the management a little bit, which created basically a new kind of status quo.
What little bit did he give the management? I'm not clear on that.
The right to, as far as workers was concerned, and scab labor. In other words, the management could close shop or it could hire other workers.
Oh, okay. Right.
Now then, as time progressed and they saw the friction that was being caused by this, the Liberals and then the NDP, realizing what the situation was, brought out legislation which eventually turned out that you couldn't hire scab workers. This was to prevent baseball bats on the line. And you know, as far as the fleck industry was concerned, what went on there,
yeah,
another industry, and what is sad about the situation, that this government now has completely reversed that philosophy, regardless of its wisdom.
Well, John, I've got a question for you, though.
Sure.
Is it appropriate for government to respond to a situation in order to prevent people from taking baseball bats to other people?
Of course it is.
So if you
and
could...
And how do you respond to it?
No, wait a minute.
So, John,
so it's okay then, if I take a baseball bat and I threaten to beat Bob's brains in, if the government doesn't give me what I want, that's okay for me to do that? And if the government gives in to me, then that's okay. That's justified.
Jim.
Answer the question, please,
Jim,
John.
Well, I'm asking you to try and understand what I'm saying.
I'm asking you to answer the question, John. Is it okay?
Well, I'm answering it. What usually starts the business on the line to start with? It's because the management hire their goons, or they bring in the OPP, as they did with the fleck industry,
mm-hmm,
and they demonstrated their power, and the union tried to demonstrate their power in a most uncivilized manner.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about a civilized approach to a problem,
okay,
which neither side seems to be able to adopt.
Doesn't civilization demand that force be abolished from human relationships?
That's what they're doing, though.
But that's not what a union is based on. And John's
the point is this. The employer invariably aggravates the situation by either relying on the OPP, relying on the government
and not relying on
good judgment.
John, you can't use the word invariably. Come on. You can't say that every employer is out to screw the employees.
He has a right to protect his property.
What I'm saying is,
but there was violence on the lines, and it came from both sides. And that this legislation, my understanding, was to try and say, instead of doing it with baseball bats, let's get to do it with lawyers or some other blunt instrument.
You cannot say it came from both sides.
And if we're talking about business versus business, is not the union and are they not well advised to adopt business practices when they're dealing with business people?
I would think they would be, yes. But one of the complaints, and I'm not making it today, but one of the complaints that has been made against some unions in some situations is they've adopted distinctly unbusiness-like attitudes to the detriment of their members.
Well, you're talking about as far as Jews is concerned.
No, I'm sorry. No,
the Rand formula was that everybody paid Jews because on the basis that everybody got the benefit of the union, whether it was a good benefit or a bad benefit, you paid Jews.
So what about my dear old dad who paid more money than he ever got out of the union?
Eh?
Did you not hear me tell the story earlier? My dad, who was forced to join the union, was forced to go on strike 4 different times, strikes that had nothing to do with his part of the business, and calculated that it cost him thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, that he well over $15,000, that he never recovered, and yet he was forced to pay dues to this union that cost him all this money.
Jim, there were sacrifices. I made sacrifices.
Oh, okay,
listen,
okay.
When I worked at Richard Wilcox...
John, I'm sorry, I haven't got time. No, I haven't got time to wait a minute. We've got a break for commercials, but I thank you for your call today, and we'll be back right after this. Well, we are just about out of time here. I want to come back, if I may, to our original premise here, which we were talking specifically about University of Western Ontario, and I want to ask each of you guys the same simple question. Do you think this is a proper atmosphere for an institution of higher learning? Is the idea that they've got to bring in a union, is this conducive to this atmosphere of academe and so on, or is it a negative? Jeffrey?
Well, unions have come a long way from their blue-collar roots, and, you know, say I'm in a union, effectively, we've got all kinds of professionals who are in unions nowadays, so I don't think there's any reason to say that just because people are in academe that it's not appropriate to have a union there. Unions have been sort of coming and going over the years. It's only about 30% of the workforce that are unionized, but I personally like unions. They've been good to me, and if the people at Western want them, they should get one.
Bob?
I think that to a large degree, the environment on the universities in our country has already been compromised and that this isn't going to help. But it seems to me that a union's trying to be used as one type of force to fight the good kind of forces, which I support, which I call market forces, and which I was trying to get a distinction of earlier in the show. Like, you know, yes, administration has certain power, but so do the owner, so do the employer, so do the students. Everyone has that power. As soon as one group unionizes, it has more power than the rest of them, because it has to be a constant negotiation. So it's not even really, I can't even say it's a two-way street. It's a multi-level street. There's all kinds of, quote, forces in there, the good kind, which is people's desires and wills and what they want to do and what they want to get. It's interesting, through our whole discussion today, we never really discussed, you know, the outcome or the quality of education or the student or the customer in this case.
Well,
you know,
because we're assuming that we're in it for the kids.
Right.
To use oft-used phrase.
So we did start on that assumption, but to me, I don't think you can just eliminate them from the equation. They are the most important force. And to me, I think that students should have freedom of choice and be able to, you know, attend the kind of learning institutions that they want. And I don't think it's, and I'm not talking about giving them that choice through government grants and freebies.
Jeff, what's your guess? Is this going to pass?
I think that it will, given the climate. And I think that as well, the other thing that we're going to see in the next couple of years is a lot more labor unrest. And I think that labor is really the thing that's going to start wages going again. We're starting to see some small increases with some of the collective agreements where there have been large profit increases. And I'm looking forward to labor getting the pump going for pay raises again.
Then you're saying the raises came out of profits, not out of labor union movement.
I noticed again, and Jeff did mention that he was a member. Still are, or was this, is this abrogated?
Well, there are bargaining agent, but Mike Harris made it illegal for lawyers to be in unions. So.
Okay, but you were a member of the Brewery Workers Union. Did you get a cut on the beer?
They're a great union, I tell you.
Yeah?
I recognize it.
Did you get a cut on the beer is what I want to know.
Can't tell. It's a union secret.
Right, okay. My thanks to Jeff Schlammer, Bob Metz, and all of our callers today for the whole show, too. A very enjoyable show from my perspective. I learned a lot about what you think about some important issues today, and I hope you got the chance to think about them yourself, too, and, you know, maybe change your mind, maybe not. Maybe confirm what you already believed. In any case, that's what we're here for every day, and we'll be back tomorrow to do the same. On Friday, we have an expert on the Titanic joining us, so don't miss that. It's going to be a fun show. Tomorrow, we've got Nose to Nose with Ms. Don and a whole bunch of other stuff. For Jeff and for Bob and for Ryan and for Don, it's Jim saying, please take care of each other, mind how you're going. We will see you tomorrow on the next Talk of the Town. Bye-bye.